All right. So, welcome back to Healing the Earth Radio. And I have with me on the phone here Mr. Richard Louv. How are you doing, Richard?
Fine. Thank you.
Excellent. So, yeah, thanks kindly for coming on the air. I'm excited to share what you have to say with people here in Guelph. And I guess to introduce yourself, do you mind maybe talking a bit about, well, introducing who you are and what Last Child in the Woods is all about?
Well, I'm a journalist and I live in San Diego, and I'm a columnist for the San Diego Union Tribune, but I also write books and do other things. The book Last Child in the Woods is about the disconnection between children and the natural world, which began a few decades ago and has accelerated in recent decades to the point that never before have so many kids in our culture at least been separated from nature physically. And ironically, this has occurred at the very moment that we are finally learning that direct contact with nature for kids is probably possibly essential and certainly very, very important to healthy child development. And so this issue has enormous implications in many areas, for the mental health of children, for their physical health, indeed for the future of the earth, because if kids are not engaged in nature, where do future environmentalists and conservationists come from?
Yeah, it's really, really important. Can you talk about maybe some of the studies that you cite a lot of really excellent studies in your book, and I wonder if you can maybe share with us some information, for example, on how kids play differently in asphalt and green playgrounds, and how children seem to inherently want to be outside with nature, but what kind of things are preventing them from doing that?
Sure. Well, this recent body of literature, which the public really doesn't know about, it's been reported in bits and pieces, that Last Child in the Woods is probably the first place it's all been put together in one spot, that, you know, in a way that people can read it and understand it. But it's really fascinating research, and it's amazing to me that this topic has been ignored for so long, probably because we just took it for granted that this relationship between kids and nature would continue forever. I mean, what has been true for thousands of years suddenly seems to be ending. So it's about time we did that research. So some of that research suggests, for instance, that any kind of exposure, direct exposure to nature for kids and adults is a great way to reduce stress. Some of the other research suggests that kids with attention deficit disorders, those symptoms decrease significantly when kids are exposed to nature, even kids as young as 5 years old. That research has been done by the University of Illinois. Other research suggests that kids may be more creative when they're exposed to nature. For example, studies of how kids play in natural playgrounds versus flat, boring playgrounds that we typically prefer in North America, perhaps more so in the United States than in Canada. I think Canada probably is ahead of us in this area. But the studies looked at how kids played on natural playgrounds that had trees and rolling grass and all that versus the flat playground. The kids that played in the natural playground played more inventively, more creatively, and indeed even more cooperatively, which is an interesting behavior change that occurs with kids when they're in nature. Other studies have been in education on cognitive functioning. Studies done in the United States in the 90s and then verified by a recent study released just a few weeks ago in California show that kids who are in schools that emphasize outdoor classrooms, those kids do significantly better in almost every academic area. According to this recently released study, they did 27% better in math and science than kids in schools that do not have outdoor classrooms. In addition, there were these interesting behavioral changes. The kids who were in schools with outdoor classrooms tended to be much more open to conflict resolution. These are just some of the studies that show the impact of nature play on kids. And indeed, many of these even more studies have been done on the impact of nature on adults recently. Some of this comes out of the biophilia hypothesis that some years ago E.O. Wilson at Harvard developed. And his hypothesis suggests that we are all still hunters and gatherers biologically. We've not changed biologically. And there is something in us that needs natural shapes on the horizon. There's something in us that needs direct contact with nature. And when we don't get it, our health doesn't do so well, mental health and physical health. So, as I say, these are just a few of the examples that I cite in Last Job in the Woods.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about how sensory stimulation is so critical for children's healthy development and how this relates to our relationship with nature?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your question.
Oh, just curious if you can talk about how is sensory stimulation so critical for child's healthy development? Like that idea of like direct sensory contact with nature.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sure. Much of this is speculative. I mean, we don't really know yet why nature is so good for kids. Strangely enough, after all these thousands of years, we're only now asking those questions. I think one of the common sense answers to that is that nature stimulates the senses. I don't think there's anywhere other than being out in the woods or the fields or along a stream or a body of water, other than maybe in a New York subway, that stimulates all of the senses at the same time. When you're sitting in front of a computer, and believe me, I'm not against computers. I love my Macintosh, and I don't really trash technology in this book. But when you're sitting in front of a computer, you're not using all of your senses. And for kids that spend hours and hours and hours in front of video games, which aren't intrinsically evil, but when they spend hours and hours and hours in front of a video game, well, frankly, it's pretty tough to use all of your senses when you're doing that. And even more important, it's really tough to get a sense of wonder in your life when you're sitting there in front of a television playing a violent video game. As opposed to being in nature, in contrast to being in nature, when you're out there, that is a direct window into using all of your senses and a direct window into a sense of wonder and humility in the world and connection to the world and a sense that there is something larger than your parents and your parents' problems. Why would we want to take that away from a whole generation of kids? And every succeeding generation. Why would we want to do that? And I think once people begin to think about that a little bit more and understand this body of knowledge that they're not aware of, I hope that nature will become much more of a priority for parents, for grandparents, for schools, for urban planners, and all of the other folks that I describe in the book as having a share in the outcome of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of work to do. And I was curious, the man Howard Gardner from Harvard, and he described different kinds of natural intelligence, different kinds of smart. I was wondering if you'd share with us a bit about what it means to be nature smart.
Well, Howard Gardner, as many of your listeners know, came up with the seven intelligences, and this is a widely accepted theory in education that kids learn differently. Some are audio learners, some are visual learners. And a few years ago, he added an eighth intelligence, which was nature intelligence or natural intelligence. He was describing the kids that seem to thrive most when they're in a natural setting. I think there's a danger in that, in assuming that's a separate intelligence. I don't think it is a separate intelligence from what I've seen of the research. I think it's something that all kids can benefit from. Again, I think it comes back to using all of the senses all of the time at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also,
one aspect of that, I might add, is that one of the main reasons that parents are not letting their kids outdoors these days is because they're afraid of stranger danger in particular. I make a speculative case in the book that kids who spend more time outdoors are actually going to be safer as kids and as adults because of the full use of their senses. because they're aware when something's behind them, as opposed to the kids that sit in front of a violent video game all the time and are, you know, pulled into that tube rather than being fully aware of the world around them. Now, that's only a speculative argument.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense, though. It makes sense to develop our inner confidence and intuition. I was also, a lot of people, when talking about, you know, social policy and all kinds of environmental issues, are almost neglect to talk about issues of spirituality or like a spiritual connection to nature. And you mentioned that a bit in your book. And I just wondered if you can share with us a bit of your comments on the spiritual necessity of nature for young and old people.
On the what?
Well, the spiritual necessity of nature for young and old people.
I think late in the book, next to the last chapter, I have a chapter called The Spiritual Necessity of Nature for Children.
Mm-hmm.
And, the chapter is at the end of the book because that topic makes people nervous. I'm not talking about worshiping nature. But I think it comes down to this word wonder or amazement. So words like that, I think, describe this special quality that nature has for kids. Now, obviously, kids can get a sense of wonder elsewhere, but I think that, you know, nature is a mainline route to a sense of wonder for children. Even the simple act of turning over rocks in the backyard and looking at that universe of bugs that lives there. If someone doesn't develop a sense of wonder early on, how are they going to have any kind of spiritual life later? So again, why would we do this? Why would we take that window of opportunity away from kids? I don't think we have to.
And why do you think we are doing this? Why do you think our nature has progressed in such a way?
Well, there are several reasons. Some of them obvious, like more time spent on video games and all that. And again, video games are not intrinsically bad, but it's the balance, the sense of balance that's been lost. Another reason is, as I said before, fear. Now, I will be the first to admit as a parent that I felt that fear and still do. And so my kids did not have the kind of freedom that I had as a boy, but I was very intentional about getting them into nature. We did a lot of fishing, still do, a lot of going out into nature. But when you look at the statistics on stranger danger, on abductions, for instance, it doesn't add up. It doesn't match this fear that exists. Abductions, at least in the United States, I don't know about Canada, but at least in the United States, have been on the decline or decreasing in number, at least for the last decade. There's a study out from Duke University this year that says that kids are actually safer from violent attacks than any time since 1975. Why then are we so terrified? And I think that what has increased is the amount of coverage that CNN and Fox and all of the other 24-hour cycle news outlets give to a very few, relatively few, horrific and tragic abductions or murders of children. That is nonstop on the tube now. You can't miss a day without seeing something like that repeated over and over and over again, month after month, year after year. That's the very definition of conditioning. We're being conditioned to live in a state of fear when actually life is a lot safer than we're being led to believe. So that fear drives kids indoors. More than that, it drives parents towards keeping their kids indoors and not trusting. Now, ironically, the Boy Scout a few weeks ago who was lost in the woods in Utah, I believe, would have been found days earlier, apparently. But he was running from his would-be rescuers. He was hiding because he had heard over and over again that he shouldn't talk to strangers. I think that's a great metaphor for what's happening to our kids. It wasn't nature that was the real threat to him at that point. It was his own fear and society's fear. So that's one reason. Another reason is, unexpected reason, is, along with the expected ones like, you know, less time that parents have, families have in general for play and recreation. But the way our communities now are built, the I have a chapter early in the book called The Criminalization of Natural Play. If you look at all the federal, state, and all the laws that are on the books, at least in the United States, and I'm sure this is somewhat true in Canada too, and then add to all of those all the environmental restrictions, mostly well-intended and mostly needed on picking up lizards, et cetera, horned toads, whatever, that are endangered. And then add to that all the covenants and restrictions that have been placed on almost every new development built in the last 20 years. And these are the kind of draconian rules, like, you know, one woman told me the other day that her community association has outlawed chalk drawings on the sidewalk. Community associations often outlaw a visible basketball hoop, let alone allowing the kids to build tree houses and forts in the open areas of these communities. It just doesn't happen. So it doesn't matter really whether or not all of these laws and regulations and covenants and restrictions are enforced, because not all of them are. But that doesn't matter, because it's the message that matters. And that message is getting through to kids. When they're sitting in front of that tube, hours after hours, according to one study, some 44 hours a week, plugged into some kind of electronic medium for kids, they're doing what the society is telling them to do. They're following orders. The society is telling them, is sending them a message in 100 ways that has basically three parts. One is nature's in the past, probably doesn't count anymore. The future is in computers and electronics. And the boogeyman lives in the woods. Now, if you're a kid or a parent, what are you going to do if you're being conditioned to believe that message day after day, year after year? We've got to change that message, because it's not doing our kids any favors. It's really cutting them off from a sense of awe and wonder, cutting them off from their senses, and it's actually hurting them physically in terms of obesity. It's hurting them psychologically in terms of stress, and it's hurting the very core of their being, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So do you want to talk a bit about change and solutions? Because they are so direly needed. What kinds of solutions are you happening that you can talk about, and what kind of things would you like to see happening?
Well, in terms of what parents can do, there's a lot in the book about what families can do, and it really starts with such things as simply leaving part of your backyard unmanicured so there's a place for your child to turn over rocks and explore the weeds and all of that. One of the things I often get asked is there five things that parents can do? And I really kind of resist that kind of list making, because it's not so much what you do or what you know. There's a great quote in the book from Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring. She said, when introducing a child to nature, it's not nearly as important what you know as how you feel. A parent who has great enthusiasm about nature, that is infectious for the kid. That's the most important thing a parent can do. Whether or not they know the names of the birds, that really doesn't count anywhere near as much as just being excited to be out there. Kids pick that up. Grandparents can play a great role. Many grandparents have a genetic memory of what it used to be like, and more young parents do not have that memory. They didn't get a chance to spend a lot of time in nature, except on organized hikes, et cetera, now and then. To those parents who did not have that experience, I say, now's your chance. Think of all the first things we do with our kids. And one of the wonderful things about this is that it's not a poisonous pill here. It's not a bitter pill to take. When you're outdoors with your child or grandchild or teacher, when you're out there with kids in nature, you're receiving all the same physical and mental, psychological and spiritual benefits that those children are receiving. The extended attention span, all those things, the parents are getting that too when they take their child out into nature. Beyond that, though, I mean, it shouldn't be just up to the parents. The schools, you know, I would hope that there would be many more natural playgrounds, many more outdoor classrooms, schools that focus on that. In the realm of urban development, one of the points that I got excited and more hopeful writing the book is when I started learning more about the green urbanism movement, mainly in Western Europe, which is designing entirely new kinds of towns and communities that are just wonderful that reduce this idea or erase this idea that somehow, a town or a city is one thing and nature is another. That's an area that a lot of urban planners would be and architects would be very excited to begin on this if there was more support on it for it. Beyond that, all the organizations, the churches and synagogues, et cetera, that could see the spiritual importance of this. In some ways, they can move faster and easier than many of the schools in terms of setting up nature programs. And having a church camp, for instance, that actually has nature in it, or that actually encourages kids to explore nature instead of being a computer camp. I mean, more and more camps have nothing to do with nature, even though they're surrounded by trees. So good that they're surrounded by trees, but how much better it would be, I think, that the old idea of the nature camp and the old idea of the Boy Scouts, et cetera, and Girl Scouts that spent more time in nature, if that were to come back. All of those things and much more I describe in Last Child in the Woods. And it's important that we get busy. There's at least half of the book is about these kind of solutions. And I'm very encouraged going around on a book tour to 14 cities that there are a lot of people very eager to move even faster on this, and I think we can.
Yeah, I really like how you offer. You're very hopeful, I think, and you'd rather not talk about fear, but you'd rather talk about hope and love.
Yeah.
I think that's great. And one of the things I really liked in your book was you talked about, I think a woman with her daughter would kind of brainstorm on different ideas of the sounds of creatures not stirring. And I wonder if you can talk a bit about that and maybe share with us a few of your own favorite sounds of creatures not stirring. I really like that concept.
Wasn't that a wonderful line? That was a poem that a mother wrote. Or actually, it wasn't a poem. She and her daughter did a list of sounds in nature. I love that list. It's in the book. I think, in answer to your question, I remember that as a boy who spent a lot of time in the woods and fields, I used to go out in the woods and I would sit under a tree. I would do several things. One is I would often climb the trees as far up as I could go until the tree began to bend in the wind. And I grew up in Kansas, Missouri. And that was a wonderful sensation. And those sounds, all of the sensations of being in nature were wonderful. Sometimes I'd sit at the bottom of the tree and I'd deliberately kind of wet my nose because I knew I could smell better if it was wet. And I would sit there and just for an hour and see what I could smell. And as I sat there, perfectly still, sometimes next to a stream or a pond, when you walk up to those kind of places, all the animals disappear and the frogs disappear. But if you sit there long enough and use all of your senses and don't move, the frogs will pop back up to the surface, the animals will come back out, and all of the sensations that you have as a child in that realm are just wonderful. And I would hope that every child has that chance.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for talking, Richard. I wonder if you have any last words at all before we finish.
I just encourage the readers to, your listeners, to be aware of this body of knowledge that's out there. I hope I've presented it well in the book. And to be hopeful.
Thanks a lot. I think you did a good job with that with your book.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for talking, Richard. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
See ya. All right. So you just heard from Richard Louvre, author of Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. And you can find out more about him on the website called thefuturesedge.com. And I just talks about how you can learn more about the book and the issues in the book and read his different columns that he writes. So that's thefuturesedge.com.